Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Satnam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanyan Wase Yaka. I hope that everything is well with you as it is with me. And I'm going to adjust our recording level a little bit. Bear with me here. For some reason it was maxed out. I hope that's a little bit better. All right. I hope you had a good weekend. I had a good weekend myself. Up here in Seattle, we're getting the very cool, the cool nights and very cool mornings as we... being far north, comparatively far north, we are beginning to realize here how short our summer is as we move toward fall. Okay, now before we start today's shiur teaching, I'll say, as I do every time, the Kaddish for the mourners of the dead. Please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you were close who has died. And in doing so, you'll honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your consciousness. Yiskadal v'yishkadash me'rabo bomo divrei ro kirose ve'yamlik melkose Bekaya kon uvyo makon, uvkaya de kol base Israel, ba'agalo uvizman karyev veyimru omen. Ye he shme rabo mevorak, leolam ule ome omayo, yisparak veyistabak veyisparar veyisromam, veyisnase veyishadar veyisala veyishalal, shmedikucho beriku. Leolo minko berkoso visharoso tushbekoso venekamoso da amaron beomo veimru omen. Ye he shlomo rabo min shamayo vekayim olenu veal kol Yisrael veimru omen. O se shalom bimromov huyashe shalom Aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael ve'imru omein. Thank you. Now, we have been, as you know, if you have been either attending these shirim or listening to the recorded versions of them on our website, we have been teaching on Torah. Not teaching out of the Torah, not lessons learned out of the Torah, but teaching lessons about the Torah, about its nature, for the last month, over a month. And that in itself is a measure of how deep spiritual subjects are and what the depth and scope is of the Torah. Just having spent about a month and a half just teaching on the nature of Torah itself. And last week, a week ago today actually, we talked about a topic which I refer to as the terror of it all. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that each person, as he or she matures, has to come to a point in their lifetime where they usually go through a crisis or a series of crises in which they discover that life is not as they have practiced it and lived it up to that point, is not satisfying. It is not fulfilling. Oftentimes, this is referred to as a midlife crisis because that's when it often happens. People will have spent the first part of their lives as a child growing up physically, as a young adult, marrying, having children, building a career, trying to reach a point in the career where they've acquired material things in life, material security, economic security, financial security, job security, having enough money that they've bought a house, they've bought an SUV, maybe they've purchased a boat to go out on the lake on the weekends, maybe if they've been especially successful, they've acquired enough financial means to purchase, to continually upgrade their home that they live in, and purchase even maybe a summer home or a cabin on the lake or in the woods in the mountains. They've climbed the ladder of their profession. And they are, by all appearances, successful. But something is missing. They have a very broad, ill-defined sense of unease about their lives. They feel like it's everything they've done has not brought them that feeling of satisfaction that they feel like it should have. And so they go through a time of crisis. And some men, especially men, I should say, meet this crisis by attempting to stick their head in the sands and deny the crisis by diving headfirst into further exploits of the body, of the senses. They will go out and buy a new car, only this car won't be a family car. This car will be a souped-up sports car, or maybe a Corvette. It'll be a bright yellow or bright red Corvette with an all-black interior. Have the latest in sound systems in it. Be a convertible. They'll maybe perhaps let their hair grow a little bit long, but not too long as to call attention to themselves in a negative way by their colleagues or supervisors at work. Oftentimes, they'll use that car as a means of attracting a younger girlfriend, and they'll embark upon an affair or a series of affairs with younger women because they will oftentimes feel that what they're missing represents lost youth, their lost youth, because now they're in their middle age. But ultimately, of course, this does not satisfy either. Most often, it ends up in destroying their marriages. Maybe they begin drinking. Usually they've been drinking before this point, so usually the midlife crisis doesn't provoke drinking, but it may worsen it. Perhaps they'll get involved in gambling, risk-taking. Things to make them feel alive, to make them feel young and vital. But none of these things will work because ultimately there is no satisfaction in life that is derived from any of the passions of the flesh or from, let's say, anything of the material world. Money, power, sexual adventures. I guess those are the big three. None of those things can satisfy one inside. They cannot bring true fulfillment. Why? Because they are all of the material world. And what is not being satisfied is the spirit in the man or woman. And that's why there is this midlife, quotes, crisis. But it's not really anything unusual. Like if we say midlife crisis, if we use those words to describe this, then it's like we are attributing to the phenomenon some sort of pathology, as if it's a disease. And indeed, many people go to counseling to try to deal with this. More people should go to counseling. Some people turn to drugs, self-medication. But the problem is not psychological or physical. It is almost entirely spiritual. And it is not a disease. It is the symptom of a stage of growth in the human psyche. It is a part of the process of individuation that every human being should and ultimately must and will go through. It's a part of the process of maturing, of moving to the next stage of one's life. Once one has done all of those things in the earlier stages of one's life that I described, involving getting married, having children, building a career, achieving some sense of economic security so you're not in fear all the time of being cast out onto the street to live in a cardboard box somewhere over a sewer grate, then it is time, in the scheme of things, the way that God has laid out the world and the natural path that man's life takes, not just man, women too, I'm talking about man in the generic sense here, Homo sapiens, that at this point in one's life, one begins the work, the true work of individuation, the hallmark work, the definitive psyche determining and defining work of individuation. And that is for the human ego to realize that it is not God, that it is not in control, that it has no power over its destiny, and that its destiny indeed is downward with the body into the earth, into the grave, but that it is here for some reason, and that there is a God that is not it, but an other, a divine other, that has made this world, and indeed made the soul and the ego. And it is when one passes through that stage of unease and finally makes the realization that his or her life is not his own to waste or perfect according to his or her own whim, that one comes to the next realization, and that is that one is a creature of God, a child of God, that God is one, that God has made the world and everything in it, and has populated it with all the animals, the birds, the fishes, the bacteria, all of the microbes, and has put man here, and has given man a difference, has made man different from all other living beings. And there must be a reason for that. And we all come to that time in our lives when that becomes a thought that we can't get rid of. And that is often presents itself in the form of a question. And this question was formulated, I think, in a beautiful way by Kurt Vonnegut in one of his novels. I can't recall the title, which it might have been Breakfast of Champions. I just can't recall. But in which the main character throughout the book is in search for the answer to the cosmic question in these words. Why are we born only to suffer and die? Okay? And that realization that we come to, that we are born and that all around us is suffering and we are suffering, and there doesn't seem, when we look at history, to have been any difference way back when and now between the level, the depth, and the scope of human suffering and the terrible things that we do to each other and that we do to the world and to the animals and other beings that we share it with. It's as if we've learned nothing in all the eons that we've been here. This is the beginning then of coming to that moment that I have called the terror of it all. It's enough to almost make your hair stand on end. If we didn't make this world, somebody else did, because, and I know there are many people, but you're not one of them, or you wouldn't be listening to me right now. There are many people out there who say, see that insanity, it's just more proof, more evidence of the fact that the world is just an accident, an accident of statistical probability. All of this came into being after the Big Bang, by which the known universe began. And it's all just a series of causes and effects, a chain. And our particular moment and condition right now is just a link in this almost interminable chain of cause and effect. And the animals and the beings of life, all living beings on this planet at this point, are just the current link in an almost infinitely, but not quite, infinitely long chain of being. But there is no God. It just is. But as I say, you don't believe in that, and I don't believe in that, because neither one of us would be here wasting our time discussing what we're discussing and trying to learn what we're trying to learn, which is about God, the universe, and man, and our relationship in it. So, we come to that point when we realize that there has to be a maker. We have a watch. That watch is ticking right along. So therefore, that watch is the evidence of a watchmaker. And more than that, the evidence of the maker is in the watch, and the maker himself is in the watch, and the maker is everywhere in the world. And by watch, I mean the universe. So we come to realize inside, even if we can't empirically prove this, we know for a certainty inside that there is a God. And we know that this God created this world. And he put us in it. And he wants something from us. God wants something from us. Or as the great Persian or Sufi poet. Now let me get his name. Hang on just a second. Known as Hafiz. said in a poem called Manic Screaming, God is trying to sell you something, but you don't want to buy. Let me just read this. It's only about six or seven lines. It's called Manic Screaming. Now know that the person who translated this put the titles on, okay? I'm not sure he had titles, the poet. But anyway, here's the poem titled Manic Screaming. We should make all spiritual talk simple today. God is trying to sell you something, but you don't want to buy. That is what your suffering is, your fantastic haggling, your manic screaming over the price. That's the terror of it all. God has made this world, God has put us in it, and God wants to sell us something. And we know we have no choice but to buy it, because his is the only game in town. And so what we're doing is we are constantly, when we come to this moment of terror in which we realize this, we immediately begin to try to learn about God and try to figure out, okay, what are going to be the terms and conditions of this transaction? Now, if we want to talk in more historical biblical terms, we can call this transaction a covenant, as it is in the Bible. There were many covenants set down, beginning with the covenant of the day and the night, the very first one. That's the covenant of consciousness. I won't get into that right now, further than that, but because that's an aside. But the fact is between man and God, there is a covenant relationship, whether the man realizes it or not. Because God blew a breath, his ruach, his Holy Spirit, a soul, into each human being while he was still in the womb, just before birth. And that human being then was no longer an animal. Because there's also a soul, a nephesh, an animal soul in every animal in the world. That's what animates them. That's what gives them their emotions, their personality. And yes, this operates in the brain, and they have portions of the brain that do this. But they, as anyone who has a dog or a cat and owns a dog or a cat knows, they have personality. They're beings. They're intelligent, knowing beings. They have consciousness. They have an animal soul. Well, so does every human being. Every human being has an animal soul by virtue of the fact that it's a living, breathing, moving, reproducing, eating, waste-eliminating being. So, at the most base level, by having a physical body, that makes us the same as every other animal in the world. But what makes us different is that God blew into our nostrils, as it says in Genesis 2:6, a breath, a ruach, and we became kayim, kaya, living, a living being. So the difference between man and the animals is that in addition to the nephesh, or animal soul, man also has a ruach. And every single human being has a ruach. Doesn't matter how spiritual you are, how much you studied any spiritual or religious path, you're born with a ruach. That's what separates you from the animals. That's what makes you a human being. Okay? But there's three other levels of soul. Those are the first two. That it's our job in our lifetime to try to perfect ourselves and acquire. Okay? And so we're human beings, and we have a divine soul in us. And that's what makes us no longer beasts of the field, no longer animals. But God has a covenant with us. He gave us this life, and we owe him something. We have a price to pay in return for that. What is that price? Well, that's what the negotiation's all about, isn't it? Well, one of the things that we find out, as I talked about last week, is that each one of us is given our own individual divine mission, a divine service to God. And we're required to work on that service during our lifetimes and hopefully complete it. And in doing that, we will perfect ourselves, not completely, most likely, because the total perfection of oneself, and what we're referring to here is not the body, but the soul. The perfection of the soul takes many lifetimes, many divine services to God, many divine missions to God. We're God's instruments in this world. Okay, but as we carry out that divine mission in obedience to God's calling and commandment, our covenant, our giving back, our paying for the gift of life, then we are naturally perfecting ourselves by doing that. Collectively, as a species, we have a divine service that we perform. We have several, but one of them is to raise up the holy sparks that are trapped in the evil husks of the abyss. If you're brand new to this, you don't know what I'm talking about right now, and that's so don't feel bad, because that's as it should be. You've just heard this for the first time, perhaps, and you'll hear more about it later. Another divine mission that we have is to help comfort God. What do you mean, comfort God? What I mean is that God suffers. God suffers in this world. He suffers for a number of reasons. First off, he suffers because he was, before the creation, the act of creation, a unity, coextensive in himself, Ein Sof, the transcendent God, everywhere and eternal, without end and eternal. But in order to create, he had to hollow a space out of himself through a process of contraction called Tzimtzum. And so by withdrawing away from it and into himself, and you can view it if you want as taking place in the navel of a divine being. And that navel pulling inward and opening inward and creating a cavity inside the area of the belly. And this was the area in which the universe and all universes, for we know there's not just one, there are an infinite number, but we'll just focus on ours right now, in which our universe was made. And then he poured the light into that void, that primordial womb. And he made everything that we can see, feel, hear, touch, the universe. Made it all. He made our dreams. Made us, the animals, all of it. Out of what? Out of Ein Sof's divine light. So he gave us this light, and in doing so, he broke himself apart into many pieces, many particles. Each one of those, each bit of light, each is both, as we know from physics, is both a wave and a particle. It's a photon, a particle, in motion as a wave with others. Each one of those particles, each one of those photons, is a piece of God. And we know from physics that matter is nothing but gravitationally trapped light. So we know that all matter is made up of the light from Ein Sof. And it is just an innumerable number of particles of God. And we'll get into more about this tomorrow in detail, about God's light and how the world was created and what that has to do with the Torah tomorrow and us. But God suffers from that multiplicity. Look at the diagram of the ten sephirot. God broke into at least 10 major attributes or pieces because God has 10 attributes. There are 10 sephirot. And we are taught by Rabbi Moshe Cordovero in his wonderful redaction of Oral Torah called Tomer Devorah, the Palm Tree of Deborah, that it is proper and fitting that a man imitate his creator being his form and likeness in the form of the ten sephirot. So we know that the diagram of the ten sephirot is a diagram of the form and likeness, the supernal body of God, the Godhead. Philosophers call it the Godhead. And so there's 10 attributes. Each have 10 names, and I've talked about that before. Each one of them has a different name of God. And so these are different manifestations of God. So God suffers from that multiplicity. God, who had one name, has 10. Actually, God has an infinite number of names, as we've talked about before, almost infinite number of names. A large number, let's say that. So God's name, which was one, has been split into many. God's being, which was one, has been split into a multiplicity of conflicting opposites, and God suffers from this. God also suffers because He is in each one of us. God's stamp in the form of what's referred to as the Imago Dei, the image of God, is imprinted upon each one of our hearts as a seal. Say, this being is mine. This being is my servant. Just as a master would hang a seal. In old days, the master of a slave would hang a slave's or servant's around his neck, a chain or with a pendant on it, and that pendant was the seal of the master. So that if anybody wanted to know, they could find out who the master was of that servant or slave. God put His seal, not around our necks, but upon our hearts. And so God suffers because He's inside of us. He's in Teferet, in also called Lev, heart, inside each one of us. And so when we suffer, it's because God is suffering. And when we suffer because of things going on in the world that are hurtful to us, painful to us, God, that little piece of God in each of us, the God of Israel that's in our heart, it suffers. The Holy One, blessed be He, is who's in our hearts. And He suffers. He feels our pain. So God is suffering. And that's one of the things that we have as a collective service, a collective avodah that we're to do, is to comfort God. How do we do that? By having mercy upon God. How do we do that? By following God's commandments, by leading lives as much as possible, lives of righteousness, by turning away from evil as much as possible, by, if we are, once we get to a higher level in our journey on the path, not turning so much away from evil as embracing the evil in order to liberate from it the holiness, the spark of holiness, God's light that's trapped inside that evil shell. These are all collective divine avodah that's been given to us collectively, but we carry out individually, but all together as a race. It's why we're here. We are God's servants. We're also here because God wants to know about His own nature. And He made us in His form and likeness so that He could look at us and say, so that's what I look like. Not just physically, that would deal with form, but likeness. how they behave, us, how we behave. We talked about in our last meeting about how he put into us the good inclination and the evil inclination, the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa. And he put us balanced perfectly in the middle to begin with and said, okay, now it's up to you. You've got free choice. You can choose. Many times each day, I'll give you the opportunity to choose between the good and between the evil. And he commands us to choose life. Life, what does that mean? Choose the right-hand side of the Etz Chaim, the tree of life. Not the left-hand side. The left-hand side is the side of death. The wages of sin are death. The wages of evil are death. The left-hand side is darkness, evil, death. The right-hand side is light, good, life. And he says, choose life. God tells us this. Choose life. I've given all this to you. Choose life. And that is why he's given us the Torah as a tool to help us do that. So that, my friends, is what I mean when I speak of the terror of it all. The point in time in our lives when we come to the point where we realize what's really going on, not what we thought was going on. And all that we thought was going on was just a diversion, like watching television. Watch television, you get all done at the end of the night, it's time to go to bed, and you go, oh, 4 hours are gone. Wow, what did I do? Not a thing. I was just entertained by the flickering lights on the TV. Well, that's the way life is. It's just like a big hypnotic television in which the movies of all of our lives are running and we're all sitting fascinated, staring at it. But sooner or later, we have to wake up and we have to realize that that's just an illusion. That's just the flickering of lights on a screen in our minds. We have to prepare ourselves then to hunt out God, to find God and establish a real relationship with God. And we do that by studying the Torah, by going inside ourselves to the God inside, the God within, the inner God of immanence, the Holy One, blessed be He, in Tiferet, in our hearts, by doing good deeds, by carrying out, making ourselves instruments of God's will in this world, making this world, doing spiritual repairs, making this world a better place by the time we leave than it was when we arrived. That's all the more that I'm going to teach on today. Tomorrow I'm going to teach on the Torah itself as being having a unique power that perfects us and perfects the world. And I'll talk about that, what that power is and how it works. And what it means, the big so what is this is why we study Torah. This is why we want to study Torah. Okay, so as I said, that's all that I have for today. So we'll close, and I ask you to remember God at least two times today, and to remember that God suffers from his multiplicity, and he suffers from his name being broken into many pieces, and he suffers because you suffer. He shares your pain, and you share his pain. And so have mercy on God, and pray to God and meditate, remember him, have empathy in your heart for God and the condition he's in so that you can have a life, so that you can be his instrument. And having said that, I now wish you well. Go from strength to strength. Zeigesund.